Now, this document's a news release announcing the White's Point Joint Review Panel to the public. And it's entitled Canada and Nova Scotia Established Joint Review Panel for the White's Point Quarry and Marine Terminal Project. And it's dated November 5, 2004. Now, at this point, Global Quarry Products was no longer the proponent of the project, right?
That is correct.
Bilcon's partnership with Nova Stone had been dissolved.
Yes.
Correct? And the sole proponent of the White's Point project was now Bilcon, right?
Yes.
Okay, but you were, I think as we know from your earlier comments, you were still the project manager, correct?
Yes.
And you're still responsible for running the EA, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, looking at this news release, it provides in the first paragraph that the panelists that would be sitting on the JRP were Dr. Robert Fournier, who was the chair, Dr. Jill Grant, and Dr. Gunter Mueke, correct?
Mueke.
Pardon me?
Mueke.
Mueke. Thank you. I'm not sure which I should use. Could I have some instructions?
Whatever.
I'm going with Mueke. Now, in the second paragraph, it provides that an agreement establishing the panel had been signed between the federal and provincial environment ministers, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And this agreement would set out the rules for conducting the JRP process, and it also contained the panel's terms of reference.
Yes.
Right? Okay. And this agreement's actually the JRP agreement that we looked at earlier at Exhibit R27, correct?
Yes.
Now, is it fair to say that as the project manager, on learning of the panelists, you looked into their backgrounds to learn about their expertise and experience?
Yes, we did.
Okay. And is it fair to say that as the panel manager, you also reviewed the final version of the JRP agreement and panel's terms of reference that we looked at earlier?
Yes.
Okay. And you would have done this shortly after this press release?
Yes, I at least when we received the copy of the agreement, we would have reviewed it. I would have reviewed it.
Okay. And indeed, you had been given opportunity earlier in the process to review and provide comment on a draft version of the JRP agreement.
That's
in
correct.
In panel's terms of reference.
Yes.
That's correct?
Yes.
Okay. Can you turn again, please, to Exhibit R-299, Mr. Buxton? Now, these are those CLC minutes we looked at earlier, and I'd like you to look at page 230 of these minutes, please. Now, these are minutes of a meeting dated November 24th, 2004, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so these minutes record a CLC meeting that was held 19 days after the announcement of the JRP members and the JRP agreement in terms of reference, right?
Yes.
Okay, and if you could turn to 232, please. It appears that there was some discussion about the panelists, and I'd just like to look at this. About a third of the way down the page, it appears that a Mr. Ivans asked if Bilcon was comfortable with the panel members, and the minutes then state Mr. Buxton replied the proponent is comfortable that the panel members understand the science. You see that?
Yes.
Okay, and then a third of the way down the page on 235. The minutes provide that Mr. Buxton noted the federal government nominated two members, and all three members are Nova Scotian. The chair, Bob Fournier, has been on several other panel reviews and in the past and is very well respected. Correct?
Yes.
Okay, and then lower down on page 235, the minutes provide that Mr. Buxton noted that if they had the option to choose, they may well have chosen these professionals. You see that?
Yes.
Okay. Now, again, this isn't a transcript, but would you agree that these minutes suggest that in November of 2004, after learning of who the JRP members were and looking into their backgrounds, you were comfortable with the three individuals that had been appointed to the White's Point JRP?
I can say that we were comfortable with the chair because we had looked into the Sable Gas project, which he chaired, and had spoken to one of our consultants, Mr. Fader, who was with Natural Resources Canada until he retired. And he had, I think, a fair amount to do with the Sable project and assured us that if Mr. Fournier was chair of the panel, that he would insist on decisions being made on a scientific basis. And that's basically what we wanted to hear.
Okay. If we could look to the bottom of page 234 now, Mr. Buxton. Now, it appears that you said the following at this meeting. Mr. Buxton noted this project is a legal project and there's nothing in law to prevent this project from going ahead. He noted there are hoops to jump through and satisfy to obtain permits, but there is nothing to say that the quarry can't proceed at White's Cove. Now, again, you read the JRP agreement in terms of reference after they were released.
Yes.
Okay. And as we saw earlier, section 6.7 of that agreement provides that the Minister of Environment shall consider the recommendation of the panel and either approve with conditions or reject the project, correct?
Yes.
So that provision does provide there's something in law to prevent the White's Point project from going ahead. Would you agree?
I think the point that I was making here is that there was no zoning in place in Digby County. So there was no prohibition under a zoning bylaw that says one can't quarry in that area. Secondly, that Nova Scotia doesn't have a coastal zone policy wherein if you wanted to quarry in a certain area, if it was inside a designated area, then the province could basically say, no, sorry, you can't quarry there. My point being here was that provided that we satisfied all the regulatory agencies, and I believe we did so, then there was nothing in itself to prohibit the quarry from going ahead.
Okay, but would you agree with me that in light of the wording of Section 6.7 of the agreement establishing the JRP, there was indeed something that could prevent the project from going ahead? That is a decision by the minister to reject.
Exactly. I don't dispute. Okay. I don't dispute that.
Thank you. Now, I want to turn briefly to the environmental impact statement guidelines that were issued by the JRP for Bilcon to prepare its EIS, or environmental impact statement. Now, a draft version of the guidelines was issued by the JRP shortly after the JRP was announced. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. The date is November 10th, 2004.
Yes.
Does that sound fair?
That sounds
okay.
Right.
Can you turn to Exhibit R209, please? Can you confirm this document is the draft EIS guidelines?
It certainly appears to be, yes.
Okay. And turning just one page over, it appears, just looking at the table of contents, that this draft was about 30 pages in length, right?
Yes.
Okay. And when the draft was released, the public was invited to comment on them, and so too was Bilcon, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Can you turn, please, to Exhibit R242? All right, this is a letter from Dr. Fournier to yourself, dated December 15th, 2004, right?
Yes.
Okay. And in it, Dr. Fornia states, "The Joint Review Panel believes that it is important for Bill Cohen of Nova Scotia's views regarding the draft guidelines to become part of the public record," correct?
Yes.
Okay, and then he writes that "The Joint Review Panel requests that Bill Cohen of Nova Scotia review the draft guidelines and return comments to the panel no later than January 21, 2005," correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if you can turn one exhibit over to R243, please. It appears that on January 16th, 2005, you provided a 2.5-page letter commenting on the draft EIS guidelines, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and in it, you provided a few comments on some, but not all of the sections of the draft EIS guidelines, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, as part of the public comment process, the JRP held 4 public meetings called scoping meetings to give the public an opportunity to comment on the draft guidelines. Is that right?
Yes.
And these meetings were held from January 6th to 9, 2005. Does that sound accurate?
That does.
Okay. And Bill, as Bill Cohen's project manager, you were free to attend these meetings, correct?
And I did attend all
the
meetings.
And you did. Okay. On March 31st, 2005, a few months later, the JRP released the final EIS guidelines, right?
Yes.
Okay. Can you turn to that? That's at Exhibit R210. Front page of this document is a cover letter from Dr. Fornia to yourself, and it attaches the final EIS guidelines, correct?
Yes.
And those final EIS guidelines are at the second page of this document?
That's could you repeat that, please?
The final EIS guidelines are at the second page of the document, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And this document, the final EIS guidelines, is what you used to prepare Bill Cohen's environmental impact statement, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the JRP, it didn't issue a hard deadline as to when Bill Cohen's EIS had to be filed, right?
That's correct.
In fact, if you look at the cover letter from Dr. Fornia on the final EIS guidelines, the first page of that exhibit, all he asked was that you advise the panel no later than April 30, 2005 as to when an EIS is likely to be submitted, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So Bill Cohen was given as much time as it needed to prepare its EIS?
Yes, there was no stipulation as to end point.
Okay. I want to ask you just a few questions now about the preparation of the EIS. Now, has the final EIS guidelines provided the instructions on Bill Cohen's environmental impact statement? I assume you reviewed them in detail?
Most certainly did, yes.
Okay. And if we can turn to the table of contents of the final EIS guidelines, it provides that at section 7 that the EIS was to contain a project description, right?
Yes.
And then looking at section 9 in the table of contents, it was asking for a description of the existing environments, including the physical, the biological, and the human environment?
Yes.
Okay. And then the EIS also had to provide an environmental impact analysis that was required for each of these environments, right?
Yes.
Okay. And one of those analyses was in respect of the human environment. And if we can look under the human environment, in the table of contents, it shows that it was to include analyses of the impact of the project on things like community profile.
Yes.
Demographics and mobility, the economy and fishing and harvesting and tourism and recreation. Do you see that?
Yes.
Okay. And land use and value.
Yes.
Okay. And things like human health and community wellness and social and cultural patterns, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, after you received the EIS guidelines, you prepared a reporting memo to Bill Clayton, and that's at Exhibit R315, which I'd like you to turn to. Now, if you could just turn one page in, you note that in the first paragraph that we have had the final environmental impact statement guidelines since the end of March and have been reviewing them since that time, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I take it from what you said about reviewing the final EIS guidelines that what you're saying here was that you'd reviewed all those sections that we just looked at.
Yes.
Okay. And also on that first page of R315, you state your estimate that you would submit the EIS by October of 2005, but that you'd give the JRP a status report on your progress, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you also make note of the time that would be put in to get the EIS completed. For example, you state that I've asked Dave Kern, our principal writer, to provide me with 40 hours work a week until the permit is granted, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, Dave Kern, he was a business associate of yours?
Yes.
No.
He's an environmental planner.
Okay. In addition to being the principal writer of the EIS, it appears that Mr. Kern was also responsible for gathering and providing scientific information regarding the impacts of project of the project on marine mammals. Is that correct?
No, I don't think that that's correct at all. Mr. Kern certainly acted as my contact person for several of the consultants. For George Alliston, certainly. For Ruth Newell, certainly. But he was not the consultant engaged in mammal research, no. Marine mammal research.
Okay, maybe if you could just assist clarifying something for me, then if you could turn to Exhibit R299 again, please. So at page 100 of that document. And I'm just three quarters of the way down the page. It's asked, Mr. Dittrich asked who is handling the information regarding marine mammals. Mr. Buxton replied that David Kern is responsible for this aspect. Now that's
yes.
The minutes. Now,
yes.
Is that accurate then?
Well, he responsible in the sense that he was responsible for lining up the experts, the consultants, and making
okay.
sure that the studies which we required under that section were in fact done.
Okay. Okay. Now, going back to R3115, on page 2 of the memo, Mr. Buxton, you state that you would be spending a minimum of 44 hours a week to get the EIS completed and a permit granted, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I'm noting here you're speaking to getting the EIS completed and a permit granted. Now, what permit are you referring to there?
This would be the environmental assessment process. It wasn't referring to anything beyond that at this stage.
Okay. So before getting to a state of a permit being granted, there'd certainly be a public and a JRP review of the EIS that Bilcon was
well,
to file, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And public hearings,
and,
obviously.
And I would be, I would commit my time through to the end of the process. Yes.
Okay. And that process contemplated the public hearings as well?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So there was far more to the process than getting the EIS completed and a permit granted.
Well, the permit that would be referred to here is the sort of the environmental clearance. Which is the first thing. After that, then there are other processes. There's the industrial approval under environment there may have been more data required by DFO, but they come after the environmental assessment process.
Okay. Now, it turns out that you filed the environmental impact statement on April 26, 2006, correct?
That sounds
correct. Okay. And that's about 13 months after the...
Microphone of Mr. Buxton has
It's on again now.
All right, good.
Sorry about that.
So that was about 13 months after the EIS guidelines were finalized?
Yes.
Okay. And thereafter, it was released for public comment and for review by government departments and the JRP, right?
Yes.
All right. Now, I want to turn to a couple statements that you make in your supplemental witness statement with respect to what the JRP expected from Bilcon. Mr. Buxton, could you turn to paragraph 55, please? Okay, at paragraph 55, you state that the JRP's report demonstrated to me a lack of understanding of the role the JRP was supposed to play in the process, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And again, this was your first JRP process that you'd acted on behalf of a proponent, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you continue in paragraph 55 by stating, when a proponent is proposing an industrial project, there are two broad stages before it becomes operational, a planning stage and a design stage. You see that?
Yes.
And then you say at paragraph 58 that the JRP expected Bilcon to provide detailed designs during the panel review process. This was not the practice or expectation in the industry.
Yes, that's what I said.
It wasn't the practice or expectation in the industry to have to provide detailed designs during the panel review process. With that, can you please turn to the draft EIS guidelines that we looked at before. It's at Exhibit R209. You there? At page 11 of that document. Can you tell us the title of Section 7.3, Mr. Buxton?
Detailed Project Description.
And under the heading Detailed Project Description, the draft EIS guidelines provided that the description must address all phases of the project in sufficient detail to allow the proponent to predict potential adverse environmental effects and address public concerns about the project. Now, from this passage, Mr. Buxton, would you agree with me that the draft EIS guidelines were attempting to elicit a project description that provided sufficient detail to predict potential adverse environmental effects and address public concerns?
That's what it says, but that is a very different thing from requesting detailed design. They bear no comparison to each other. In fact, The whole point of holding an environmental assessment at the planning stage is so that these sorts of the environmental issues can be reviewed at the planning stage, and in fact, major decisions made in that process, which will be of significant environmental advantage. And a good example of that would be the process that we went through to determine what sort of marine terminal we would have. Would we have a massive rock fill? Would we have a pipe pile? Would we have, if it's even possible, a floating structure out there? Because each one of those comes with an environmental burden. And you you go through the process at the planning stage to see what the environmental effects of each of these are, and then basically you select during that process the one that has the least environmental consequences, okay, which for us was the pipe pile structure. And that is what it means by the detailed project description. It means what sort of marine terminal are you going to use? Are you going to have a massive rock fill, or are you going to have a pipe pile structure, so that we can assess the environmental effects of those? What it does not mean is that we need to define precisely that the pipe pile should be 36 inches in diameter or 39 inches in diameter, whether the steel should be 5/8 or 3/4 steel. We don't need to know that at this stage. That's an engineering thing, and that comes at the industrial approval stage. My comments here go to the fact that the panel continued to demand throughout the process detailed design. And detailed design is simply not a part of the environmental assessment process. You can't, you simply can't do the detailed design for a project, even this is a relatively simple project, at the environmental assessment stage.
Okay,
it's monstrous. You'd end up with on some projects the detailed design might be 10,000 sheets of drawings. You don't do that at the environmental assessment stage. You do the environmental assessment at the planning stage, okay? And then you know, the client, the proponent knows, in fact, you know, what major decisions have been made from an environmental sense. And then you get into the detailed design.
Okay. Can you turn, please, Mr. Buxton, to exhibit R219. I want to look at an example of the kind of information the JRP was requesting then. Now, this was a letter from Dr. Fournier to yourself dated July 26, 2006.
Yes.
And it attached information requests that were issued by the JRP after you submitted Bilcon's EIS, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, information requests are a standard part of any EA process or JRP process, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And indeed, the final EIS guidelines put Bilcon on notice that following the release of the EIS for review by the public, the panel might be requesting further information from Bilcon, right?
Yes.
And indeed, some of the information requests that were issued after Bilcon filed its EIS focused on the project description Bilcon had provided.
Yes.
Okay. So can you turn to page 3, please, of the information request? Now, regarding the project description, it appears the JRP's concerns were that the level of detail for most project components described in the EIS is not adequate for the panel to properly understand the project and assess its potential effects or to judge the effectiveness of proposed mitigation measures, and that discrepancies in the various documents and maps make it difficult for the panel to confirm where activities occur. You see that?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I want to just turn to an example of one on page 5 of this information request. Now, at the bottom of page 5, it states, plans op 1 to op 4 show the organic and sediment disposal areas for the first 20 years located on slopes that range possibly up to 25%. Sediment retention structures are usually sited on level ground or in depressions. Provide details on the berms along with measures proposed to prevent downslope movement of the sediments and berms by creep or flow. What mitigative and contingency plans are proposed in the case of berm failure during extreme precipitation events? Now, from this request, Mr. Buxton, would you agree with me that in this instance, the JRP was simply requesting project design information that would allow it to assess the potential environmental effects of the use of the disposal areas
and effectiveness of mitigation approaches, given where they appear to be located on maps that you'd submitted with the EIS?
Again, the design of berms is a very commonplace thing in the engineering world. In order to do a final design, you would need to know precisely where that berm was. Not that it was 20 feet this way or 20 feet that way, but that the berm was precisely there. Not only that, but if I were designing the berm, I would go dig a test hole there. I'd find out what the overburden was, as well as things like the slope of the rock. So to do a detailed design, when we could not say within plus or minus 50 feet where that berm is going to be, is just simply a waste of paper. But the fact is that it's an exercise which is well within the capacity of any competent engineer to design a berm. After all, we have berms, which in fact get translated into earthen dams, which are 200 feet high. We're talking about a berm here, perhaps 5 meters high. There's nothing complicated or technical about this, but there's no point in doing a detailed design unless you know the precise spot that it's going to go on. So to basically say that this is how we're going to do this is or should be adequate at this stage. The Nova Scotia Department of Environment could look at that and say, well, you're now in the industrial approval stage, so we would like detailed designs of that berm. And by this stage, of course, we're through the environmental assessment process, we're doing detailed site planning, we know exactly where everything will go on the site to within plus or minus 6 inches, we know where the berm will go, and we'd be very happy then to design that berm as we are required to do and pass the design to Nova Scotia Department of Environment and Labour. It's simply not appropriate at this stage here. It's certainly appropriate to recognise that is or could be an environmental issue.
All right.
All right.
You still haven't answered my question, Mr. Buxton. It was a pretty simple one. Would you agree with me that in this instance, the JRP was simply requesting project design information that would allow it to assess the potential environmental effects of the use of these areas and the effectiveness of your mitigation approaches given where they appeared to be located on the original project designs, which was on slopes of up to 25% in gradient?
No, I wouldn't agree with that, no.
You wouldn't agree that the JRP was... Can you let me finish the question, please? You would not agree that from this information request that this is what the JRP was requesting?
I know what they're requesting. They were requesting detailed design and continuously requested detailed design through this process. This isn't the only instance of the request for detailed design. And it is not appropriate at this stage of environmental assessment. Period.
And you didn't think it was appropriate, notwithstanding the JRP's concerns, that it didn't feel it could assess the environmental effects of these disposal areas, given what you had presented?
I don't know whether there was anybody competent on the JRP to do that, but certainly they had the option, if they wanted to hire their own engineer to take a look at our conceptual plans and say, are those reasonable conceptual plans?
Okay. Can you turn to Exhibit R255? And that's a excerpt from your response to the information request of the panels. And in responding to this information request, you noted reference to plans OP1, R1 to OP7, R1 shows a refinement of the organic and sediment disposal areas so that they are now located on essentially level ground, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in responding to that information request, you redesigned the sediment, or the retention areas to put them on level ground, correct?
I did not mean in any way, shape, or form to suggest that we would not do what the panel asked. And in fact, we went to great lengths to do what the panel asked, even to rearranging redesigning or replanning the site to satisfy the panel. My point is very simply this, that detailed design is not required in an environmental assessment process. If the panel seemed to be concerned about things, we were not going to get into an engineering debate at this part of the process. And if we could, we would simply move the stuff around on the site to remove their concerns.
Okay. One other thing about responding to the information requests of the JRP, Mr. Bunk. So now, after the JRP issued its first series of information requests, I understand that Bilcon retained AMEC. Is that correct?
I'm sorry?
AMEC. Bilcon retained AMEC, A-M-E-C?
AMEC, yes.
AMEC.
Yes, yes.
Okay. And AMEC is a consulting firm that conducts environmental assessments, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And this was in or around August of 2006?
AMEC had been working for us long before that. AMEC was engaged. AMEC are a very large company with a tremendous amount of experience in environmental assessments, and they were our consultants from day one on the human element of the human component of our environmental impact statement. So they've been around for a long time on that particular element. We hired Dr. Susan Shirk to supervise the entire human element, okay. Human component element. In 2006, as we got into some of the requests from the panel as to how to how they would like things arranged in the EIS, we went back to AMEC, and particularly to somebody who was very familiar with putting EISs together, and engaged him to do a very significant amount of work for us. Yes.
Can you turn to exhibit R317, please? Now, this is an exchange between Josephine Lowry and a, with apologies, Judge Sima, Uwe Wiedkugel. Thank you. Correct?
Yes.
Okay. And it's dated August 31, 2006?
Yes.
And Josephine, who was she?
Josephine was the person in my office putting together the document itself.
Okay.
Yes.
And in the exchange, Josephine notes that Paul and I feel a great deal more comfortable with the entire process now that AMEC is on board for guidance, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and the Paul she's referring to is you?
Yes.
Okay. Now, do you take issue with what Ms. Lowry has stated here to Mr. Wiedkugel?
No. I think Uwe Wiedkugel, in particular, was very helpful in structuring parts of the EIS. And we were very pleased with his work. And okay. That's what she's alluding to.
And this is, of course, though, after the EIS had originally been filed and when you're dealing with information requests at this stage, correct?
While we were dealing with information requests,
okay.
Yes.
Could I just ask either of you to clarify for me what the copper issue was? Copper issue. This is what this Wiedkugel thing turns around. It says, hi, Uwe, I'm working on getting the copper questions together. And later on it says, I had identified two ecotoxicologists who are available to look into the copper issue.
If I could, yes. Mr. Mr. President. It was an information request from the panel, and I assume that it was probably generated by Gunter Muick. And he noted that we had not done a significant section on the presence of copper in the rock. It is well known in the area that the middle flow unit of the basalt has high concentrations of copper, and it's been leaching into the water and into the Bay of Fundy for a long time. And in fact, yes, okay, yep.
But Mr. Kugel was retained on more issues than just the copper issue. He provided you assistance with responding to the information request, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I have just a couple questions about the hearing before the JRP, Mr. Buxton. Now, the hearing was held in June of 2007.
Yes.
Correct? And if you turn to paragraph 73 of your first witness statement.
Of the first one, sorry?
Yes, the first. On paragraph 73, you state that Bilcon also expected that individuals or groups making presentations before the panel would submit their presentations 10 days before the hearings. Since the panel did not enforce this requirement, Bilcon was unable to prepare for questions of a highly technical nature that were posed to Bilcon without notice. Bilcon was also not provided an opportunity by the panel to respond in the following days, as it expected it would have the opportunity to do so. Now, while you note that Bilcon was not provided an opportunity by the panel to respond in the following days, you don't provide any evidence in your witness statement that you actually asked for such an opportunity, do you?
No.
Okay. Would you agree with me that you could have asked for such an opportunity?
I don't. We just simply we wouldn't have been able to. What would we? How would we respond to material that was launched at us in the 13th day of the hearing? A fairly lengthy and perhaps technical report. How would we have responded to that?
So you wouldn't have even thought about asking for the opportunity to respond to that as a result? Is that what you're saying?
I don't recall asking for the opportunity to respond. For some of these, I think it is it's an important point. We had no idea who the people were who were presenting some of these technical papers. The panel certainly didn't require them to provide us with a CV, so we didn't know whether these people were amateurs or whether they were professionals or whether they'd been hired to make a presentation on a fairly highly technical subject. We didn't know quite what we were dealing with, because we were supposed to have that material before the hearings. We just didn't get it.
And so as a result, you didn't see the need then to ask for the opportunity to respond or to
wasn't the question
address it
of that.
Later.
I don't think we would have been able to respond by the end of the hearings.
You couldn't have asked for an undertaking, Mr. Buxton, to respond or an opportunity to respond? I mean, the day that one of these presentations was made, you couldn't have asked for the opportunity to address it later on in the hearings?
Oh, well, that's possible, but some of them were obviously a very significant amount of time went into the preparation of these things. And, if we'd had them 10 days before, and this applied also to some of the government presentations that were not there in time. And the whole purpose of this is to look at to enable the proponent to look at the presentations prior to the hearings and if necessary, assign its consultants to review them and prepare a response. When they're dumped on you halfway through the hearings, you really have no opportunity at all to do anything with them.
Mr. Buxton, if you're saying that these presentations only had to be provided 10 days before the hearing,
yes.
Well, that's not a heck of a lot of time either. So it wouldn't have been reasonable to try to address them when they came up to you or if they came up to you during the hearing, if you only had 10 days in the first place?
Well, you're assuming you only had 10 days if they came up on the first day of the hearing. The hearings were, 15 days. We would have had certainly adequate time to determine whether they were valuable, scientific, and prepared by somebody that had the necessary training. We didn't know who these people were that were making these presentations.
Okay.
There were no CVs. We didn't know whether they were university professors with a high degree of skill and capacity and experience, or whether they were people off the street. We had no idea.
We focused thus far on the White's Point Quarry and Marine Terminal project, Mr. Buxton.
Yes.
And I want to now turn to that 3.9 hectare quarry on the White's Point project site that you've discussed in your witness statements.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you were involved in applying for the industrial approval for the 3.9 hectare quarry, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And this application was made to NSDEL?
Yes.
All right. And if you could turn to Exhibit R75, please. This document is entitled Application for Approval to Operate a Quarry, right?
Yes.
And it was submitted by Nova Stone Exporters, correct?
Yes.
And if we turn in one page, it appears that the application for approval was made February 18th, 2002, right?
That sounds correct.
Okay. And looking at Section 1, it says that Nova Stone Exporters would be the owner. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And in Section 2, it lists yourself as the applicant contact, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if you can turn 9 pages in, there's a project description.
Yes.
Okay. Now, in the second paragraph of the first page of the project description, Mr. Buxton, it stated that it is proposed that approximately 50,000 metric tons of basalt will be quarried and crushed per month, correct?
Yes.
All right. And then at the bottom of the first page, it states the rock will be quarried in 40-foot lifts on a 400-foot face, which will advance to the south, and the total area to be quarried under this permit application will be approximately 6.5 hectares.
Yes.
Okay. So this project description describes how the 3.9 hectare quarry would be operated and developed. Would you agree?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I understand that after this application, Nova Stone had to reapply for the 3.9 hectare quarry due to a technical issue with the size of the quarry footprint, correct?
Yes.
Okay. It was found to be just slightly over 4 hectares and could have required an environmental assessment under Nova Scotia law. So there was a reapplication.
Yes.
Okay. And that reapplication was made April 23rd, 2002?
That sounds correct.
Okay. Now, we know that NSDEL issued an industrial approval for the 3.9 hectare quarry 7 days later after that reapplication on April 30th, 2002, right?
That sounds correct, yes.
Okay. And if you can turn to Exhibit R87, please. Now, this is a letter from Bob Petrie to yourself.
Yes.
And it's dated April 30th, 2002, right?
Yes.
Okay. And it attaches the approval for the 3.9 hectare quarry.
Yes.
And Mr. Petrie's letter in the first paragraph notes that the approval was issued to Nova Stone Exporters.
That's correct.
Okay. And indeed, the first page of the approval provides that the approval holder is Nova Stone Exporters, right?
Yes.
Okay, so Bilcon didn't apply for this industrial approval, correct?
No.
Okay. Now, we've had a little bit discussion earlier on, this was, I believe Mr. Nash said, an approval subject to conditions. Because Nova Stone's quarrying operations couldn't proceed on the 3.9 hectare site until certain conditions were satisfied, right?
That is correct.
Okay. And these related to the impact of blasting on the 3.9 hectare site on the marine environment, correct?
Yes, in addition to all the other conditions under the NSDEL.
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Now, those conditions regarding blasting are in paragraphs 10H and 10I.
Yes.
Okay. Now, Nova Stone, it applied for and it received the conditional industrial approval for the 3.9 hectare quarry before you submitted any project description for the White's Point project, correct?
Yes.
As we know, this conditional approval was issued April 30th, 2002?
Yes.
Okay. And that draft project description for the White's Point project that you filed, I think, was provided to government officials, Helen McPhail specifically, on September 30th, 2002, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Because you wanted, at that point, you wanted to get the regulatory review of the larger White's Point project up and running, correct?
Yes.
All right.
We certainly wanted to be, I certainly wanted to advise NSDEL that was the thinking of the proponent at that time.
Okay. Yes. Now, this was around the very same time that you were preparing and providing information for DFO's review in connection with those blasting conditions that we just mentioned.
Yes.
Correct? Okay. So, in other words, when you filed the draft project description for the White's Point project, the industrial approval that we're talking about here, that for Nova Stone's 3.9 hectare quarry, was still conditional on the conditions, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, when we look at Exhibit C-47, Mr. Buxton, that's the draft project description that we looked at earlier?
Yes.
Okay. On page 2 of this draft project description, at the top of the page you state that the land-based infrastructure of the White's Point Quarry, or sorry, you state the land-based infrastructure, and I think you're referring to the White's Point Quarry, will be constructed on the previously approved 3.9 hectare quarry site. You see that?
Yes.
Okay. And the components of the land-based infrastructure, they're listed on page 1 of the draft project description, correct?
Yes.
And they include things like office facilities and workshop facilities and fuel tanks and environmental controls such as sedimentation ponds, correct?
Yes.
So Nova Stone's 3.9 hectare quarry was fully contained within the site of the quarry for the White's Point project, correct?
Yes.
And Nova Stone's 3.9 hectare quarry would actually be where the infrastructure that was needed for the operation of the larger quarry would be constructed. Is that right?
Certainly a part of it, and as the project description, and obviously the project description became much more detailed, and it is an iterative process. As more decisions are made, the project description gets more precise as you go along, and certainly it would be incorrect to say that all of the infrastructure required for the larger quarry could have been contained on the original 3.9 hectare site.
Well, fair enough. Why don't we look at the final project description for the White's Point project, which is just a few documents after C-47 in Exhibit C-499, Mr. Buxton. Now, there's some page numbers on this document, and I'd like you to turn to a map that's at page 001049 in the bottom right-hand corner. Okay, now, this is called the White's Point Quarry Infrastructure Plan, this map. And this map actually shows the boundaries of the 3.9 hectare quarry, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And some of the, not all, but some of the infrastructure for the larger quarry was to be built on the 3.9 hectare quarry.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. So, for example, we can see on the site of the 3.9 hectare quarry, the sediment retention pond, a shop, and fuel tanks, and an office, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And it appears also from this plan that the 3.9 hectare quarry is almost as close as you could get on the White's Point property to the Bay of Fundy. Would that be a fair characterization?
Yeah, it's about 100 meters back. I don't know if that's the...
Well, it's certainly closer to the Bay of Fundy than the majority of the White's Point project site. Would
yes.
you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Now, if you turn a few pages in on C-499 to a page with page numbering 1041 on the bottom...
Yes.
It's zero. That is confusing, but yeah, it is. It's the second last page of the text, and it has 4-1 on the bottom of it. Okay. Here you actually make mention of Nova Stone's 3.9 hectare quarry. At the top of the page, you note that a blasting plan is under review for the 3.9 hectare quarry. Well, here you refer it's, you call it a 4 hectare quarry, but I think it's the 3.9 that we're referring to. And you also state that a primary objective of the 4 hectare blasting plan is to gather specific on-site data for further assessment of potential impact on the marine environment from blasting operations, correct?
Yes, but I think it would be certainly worth noting that I do say in this document that the blasting plan was prepared and submitted to the department for approval, and this is to satisfy condition 10I specifically, and. I wrote that because I had no knowledge of what, in fact, was going on in DFO at the time. And certainly, I now know that, in fact, in September, the end of September 2002, so long before this was written, that the DFO scientist, who was the writer of the guidelines for blasting in or near Canadian fisheries waters, had in fact said to his DFO colleagues that he saw no difficulty with us blasting with respect to marine mammals as long as we observed, kept an observer, within a 1 kilometer area of the blast. But we were never told that. And also, I should say, because it relates precisely to this, is that in early December, the DFO whale expert advised his colleagues that were reviewing this plan that given the mitigation measures that we'd already set out, that he had no difficulty whatsoever with us blasting on the 3.9 hectare quarry with respect to whales. But we were never, ever told that by DFO. So while I'm still saying here we're waiting for approval from DFO, DFO's scientists has already cleared it, but they would not tell us, and in fact never did tell us, ever, that we had satisfied their whale expert or their blasting expert with respect to mitigation.
Mr. Buxton, that's all helpful information that we've heard from your counsel yesterday. I wanted to put this statement to you, ask a simple question.
Yes.
With respect to what your intentions were with the 3.9 hectare quarry. Okay?
Yes.
So you wanted to conduct a test blast on
yes.
the 3.9 hectare quarry?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Now, test blasting wasn't the only purpose of the 3.9 hectare quarry, was it?
It was certainly a significant part of it. Recognize that you're going into a large project with a potential capital expenditure of, my guess at that time, about $45 million to open this quarry and marine terminal. So, you know, one of the things that we certainly wanted to do was to take a closer look at the rock, drill some boreholes, you know, do all the things, the due diligence from the business perspective on that site. And certainly we knew that blasting was an issue with respect to cetaceans and pinnipeds, whales, and things like seals and porpoises. And we wanted to gather that hard empirical data so that if we were required later on, with respect to the quarry, to provide that information, we would have the hard data.
But test
and,
blasting...
know, we were never allowed to do that, ever.
Okay. Test blasting wasn't the only purpose of the 3.9 hectare quarry. Do I understand that's a correct statement?
It was an investigative quarry. But it still, under its permit, was allowed to, in fact, blast and crush rock.
So you'd agree with me then that test blasting was not the only purpose of the 3.9 hectare quarry, Mr. Buxton?
No, it was not the only purpose. You know, I don't know whether you had the opportunity to walk over from Highway 217 to the quarry, but it's a pretty rugged old road over there, and in fact, there's no vehicular access anymore. And one of the things that we needed to do was to improve access to the site for things like drill rigs, and where were we going to get the rock for that? Well, a little mobile crusher on the 3.9 hectare site would have enabled us to do that.
Okay, well, maybe we can actually look at a document that I think reflects that. If you can turn to Exhibit R151, please. Okay, this is a letter from yourself to Derek McDonald of the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency.
Yes.
Excuse me. And you were dealing with Derek McDonald on the White's Point project in the first half of 2003.
I was, yes.
Okay. And this letter is dated April 20th, 2003?
Yes.
Okay. And indeed in the letter you state that Novastone's intentions for the 3.9 hectare quarry are to open it in accordance with the approval and crush rock, correct?
Yes.
And you add that this rock will be used initially for the construction of the various environmental controls as set out in the application for the 3.9 hectare quarry and to construct a new access road to the 3.9 hectare quarry, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So one of the intentions then was to blast and crush rock and start building environmental controls for the quarry site, correct?
Sentence one there has a very specific purpose. The 3.9 hectare quarry, which was an approval to open a 3.9 hectare quarry to crush rock, carried with it conditions, but it was not conditional upon the purpose for which the rock would be used. And that was an approval document. It wasn't a conditional approval. It was an approval with conditions. And I was asked, now this is a response to something from Derek MacDonald, asking us what we intended to do with the 3.9 hectare quarry. And we had an approval to blast and crush rock on that quarry. And I'm just saying, Nova Scotia's intention for the 3.9 hectare quarry to open it in accordance with the approval and crush rock. We have an approval to do that. Do you see my point here?
I see your point. You're answering a whole bunch of questions that you're giving me a whole bunch of answers for questions that I'm not asking.
Well, I think you did ask the question because you asked me what we were going to use the rock for. And I specifically state in here that, yes, we're going to use it for environmental controls and to upgrade the White's Cove Road. But in a sense, the primary thing is that we have an approval to open a quarry and crush rock. We have the approval.
Okay. I think you finally gave me the answer that to the question that I was asking. Okay. Can you turn, please, to Exhibit R551, Mr. Buxton? It's R551. I'm not sure you're at the right document, Mr. Buxton.
No, sorry.
It is on the screen if you'd like to look at the screen. But that's it there.
Yes, okay. Got it.
Okay, now this is an excerpt of the 2003 Journal of Derek MacDonald with some confidential information that's been redacted. And under the date of Tuesday, June 10th, Mr. MacDonald records the substance of a conversation that he'd had with you at about 9:45 a.m. that day. He notes that you informed him that you now had an opportunity to bid on Highway 217 upgrading work worth a certain amount, but unable to because blasting plan not approved. You see that?
Yes.
Okay. So you also wanted to get blasting on the 3.9 hectare quarry in order to have a supply of rock that could be used to bid on highway upgrading work. Is that fair to say?
Not necessarily, but that was a reality. This was an opportunity. If the owner of the quarry, who had an approval, were allowed to blast, then he could have. That would have been his choice. This was the point that I was making. It was just a lost opportunity.
Okay. Now, you'd agree with me that the EA of the larger White's Point project was underway by this point, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, Nova Stone wasn't able to blast on the 3.9 hectare quarry and accomplished these objectives that we've just talked about because DFO still hadn't provided written acceptance of the blasting conditions in the approval subject to conditions, correct?
That is correct, even though they knew perfectly well that we had satisfied condition 10i. Their own scientists and their own marine expert had explicitly said internally to their staff that we had satisfied them, and we were never told that. Okay. 10i had in fact been satisfied since way back at the end of September 2002.
DFO actually determined, Mr. Buxton, that the proposed blasting activity on the 3.9 hectare quarry would actually require or likely require a Section 32 authorization, didn't it?
That's what they wrote to us. We never believed that for one moment, even though we didn't have the information that DFO had at the time, which was, in fact, that there would be no harm whatsoever. The guidelines for blasting in or near Canadian fisheries waters are, in fact, designed primarily to protect fish. They do also cover mammals, but there's less scientific veracity in those, but certainly they are designed and they're DFO's guidelines. And the blast that, in fact, our first test blast would have been double the distance from the water required under the guidelines with a lower charge. So we've got two safety factors in there. And, in fact, DFO scientists basically said they had no difficulty. They had no problem.
Mr. Buxton, would you answer my question, please? DFO made a determination that it communicated to Nova Stone that blasting activity on the 3.9-hectare quarry would likely require a Section 32 authorization. It's a simple question. Please, Mr. Buxton.
Excuse me, Mr. President. Mr. Buxton has fully answered that question. It's an unfair intervention by counsel. It's unfair to the witness. He already answered the question. He answered it at the beginning of the last answer. And to say he hasn't answered the question is just not simply accurate.
So the answer to the question consisted in you stating at the outset
we received that letter from DFO saying that, it, in their opinion, a Section 32 was required. Yes. We certainly received
that.
Yes.
That was the question.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Now, I take it from your comments, Mr. Buxton, that your view at this point was that DFO was wrongfully withholding acceptance of the blasting plan for the 3.9-hectare quarry.
Absolutely.
Okay. Can you turn, please, to Exhibit R382, please?
R382,
please. Now, this is a letter from yourself to NSDEL's Bob Petrie, correct?
Yes.
And it's dated June 25, 2003?
Yes.
All right. And in it, you state in the last paragraph on page 1 that DFO has taken the position that our entering an EA phase for the proposed larger quarry prevents them from taking any action on the 3.9-hectare quarry. We strongly disagree with this position and can now advise that DFO's position is preventing Nova Stone Exporters, Inc. from operating the 3.9-hectare quarry, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and then on page 2, you note, these are serious financial consequences which arise from our inability to operate in accordance with the permit, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and would it be fair to say that these types of consequences included, for example, the inability to have that opportunity to bid on highway upgrading work?
No, the serious financial consequences here are that we're going into a process and certainly a comprehensive study process without firm empirical data which would have been provided by test blasting. And you can see at the end of the day in the panel report itself, basically saying they're confused about the blasting and wouldn't it have been better if there had been a test blast. And that's what we were trying to do for what, 6 years, was simply conduct a test blast to provide good, sound, empirical data. And further than that, I am absolutely of the opinion that certainly the scientists in DFO would have welcomed that data. They had virtually nothing with respect to whales. They had nothing. Their scientists basically said, we're flying by the seat of our pants. They would have had all this technical data from numerous blasts throughout the process. We were going to monitor every blast, not just the initial blast. This was a real opportunity for them to gather real scientific data, and we were prevented from doing that, period.
Okay, Mr. Buxton. In the first full paragraph on, the second full paragraph on page 2 of this letter, you state the company has suffered significant costs due to the delay and the jurisdictional machinations employed by DFO. So you're saying that the company has suffered significant costs refers to the inability to conduct a test blast?
Which one are you quoting from now? I'm sorry.
On page 2 of this letter, the second full paragraph, the first sentence.
Well, the whole issue of 10I was very significant to us. It had to be something that was overcome, and here we are writing literally in June 2003, when we now know that 10I was in fact covered in September of 2002. And we were satisfied that we had in fact satisfied condition 10I, and every month of delay on this project was a cost delay to provide the information that we required to go to the next level. And that's what I'm referring to here very clearly. These are significant costs when there's a delay. Where were we going to go if for our technical data, if DFO continuously refused to approve 10I?
Okay, so as of the date of this letter then, you were of the view that DFO was wrongfully not permitting Nova Stone to operate the 3.9 hectare quarry, but also that Nova Stone was suffering costs or damages as a result of this non-permission.
Yes, any delay in the process, is a cost to the proponent.
Okay. Just a few more questions regarding the 3.9 hectare quarry. Now, after the White's Point project was referred to a review panel, but before the joint review panel was constituted, the Global Quarry Products Partnership underwent a corporate reorganization, correct?
It did.
Okay. And this corporate reorganization took place sometime after March 1st, 2004?
Yes.
Okay. And the reorganization led to the partnership being dissolved, correct?
Yes.
And Bill Kahn became the sole proponent of the project then?
That is correct.
Okay. Now, could you please turn to Exhibit R94, Mr. Buxton? Now, this is a letter from yourself to Mr. Jean Crepeau.
Yes.
All right. And Mr. Crepeau is at the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency, correct?
He was a replacement panel manager at that time.
Okay. And the letter's dated August 17th, 2004. And then you note in paragraph 1 that the partnership between Bilcon and Nova Stone had been dissolved?
Yes.
And that Bilcon was the proponent of the project?
Yes.
And held the lease for the entire White's Point project property, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, in paragraph 2, you note that as Bilcon now held the lease for the entire property, the conditional industrial approval for Nova Stone's 3.9 hectare quarry was no longer valid, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And this was because the conditional or the approval subject to conditions was only valid if the approval holder, which was Nova Stone, controlled the land on which the quarry was to operate.
That is correct.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. And then on page 2, you noted that Bilcon did not intend to ask NSDEL to transfer the conditional industrial approval to Bilcon, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So in looking at the points in this letter, would you agree with me that the conditional industrial approval for Nova Stone was a dead issue as of the date of this letter?
Yes.
Okay. In fact, it would have been a dead issue as of the date that Bilcon entered into the lease for the entire White's Point property, correct?
Yes, it would have been effective on that date. Okay. I would say that there was a decision made to not ask the minister for a transfer. And part of that was that it appeared that we're way into 2004 now, that we were never going to get 10I cleared. And since we were never going to get 10I cleared, it was in fact somewhat of the approval was somewhat of an impediment to us. And DFO had made it very clear to us from the beginning at meetings and in correspondence that in fact we did not require permission from DFO to conduct a test blast. And the reasoning behind that is that Section 32 makes it an offense to kill fish unless by fishing. The problem with not applying for an authorization under Section 32 is that if one kills fish, then there are serious penalties. And certainly the penalties to us would have been not just financial penalties, but also penalties to reputation. We did not want to go that route. We wanted to go the high road route, if you like. And clearly we were not going to get a permission to blast on the 3.9-hectare quarry. That 10I was just never going to be given to us. And we would have had the option, in fact, without the quarry permit there, to revisit the issue of, in fact, test blasting on a piece of property that was no longer subject to 10I. We never did so, but that option was there for debate at that time.
Those are my questions, Mr. Buxton. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Little.
Mr. President, I will have some questions in re-examination, but I think this would be an appropriate time for lunch if
would you prefer to do this after the?
I would prefer that, and if that's okay with the panel, I'd be pleased with that.
Yes, I think that should be fine. So we are going to have the lunch break now, which and we will continue at in an hour, precisely in an hour's time, which would be 1:35. And thank you, Mr. Buxton.
Thank you, sir.
Unfortunately, you're not yet in freedom, and I have to repeat that during the lunch break, would you please keep away from the people here and have a solitary lunch somewhere, which is probably what you prefer at this stage anyway. Thank you very much.